Yo, I'm Gorgasm from Smash Mouth, and you're listening to the Wellington Podcast.
You are indeed. My name's Bevan McCabe. You're listening to the first episode of the Wellington Podcast in October 2009. In the Wellington Podcast, we talk to some interesting people in around Wellington to find out what they're up to. We cover a big range of topics. If you're in Wellington and doing something interesting, we'd like to hear from you. So, let's get started. First up, we talked to someone from the Rochester City Roller Derby. Also talking to Rian Sheehan, Wellington electronic musician and soundtrack composer, in advance of his October show at the Downstage. We also have time for a chat with a couple of tourists. We'll also be talking to Claire Metcalf, Wellington's only full-time quiz mistress, who also runs her own events company. If you'd like to get in touch, you can email wellingtonpodcast@gmail.com, and you can also look on our website, which is wellingtonpodcast.blogspot.com. The podcast is available on iTunes. If you have iTunes on your computer, just go to the music store and look under podcasts, search for Wellington, and then you can subscribe so that each new episode gets automatically downloaded to your computer.
Alright, this is MC Growler from the Rochester City Roller Derby, and you're listening to the Wellington Podcast.
I'm liking it, that was a lot of hamming up. So, first up we've got the Rochester City Roller Derby. Before their last bout at the TSB Arena, I talked to a few of the members of Brutal Pageant. The interview is at One Red Dog, so apologies for a bit of background noise here.
So we're talking with four of the skaters from the Rochester City Roller Derby. Can we just start and introduce yourselves, please?
Sure, I'm Ruby Death Skates.
And I'm Wax Assassin.
I'm Thigh Voltage.
And I am Ginger Tonics.
Someone tell me, what is roller derby?
Roller derby is an all-women's full-contact sport on roller skates. Basically, yeah, it's a great sport about women and athleticism and power, and yeah, it began back in the day in the States. We've had a revival in 2001, and we've been playing in Wellington since 2007 when we started training, and this is our third bout and the second one of our inaugural season, so civil offences.
And how did you come to be involved in it?
Not really sure. Actually, I heard about it from a friend of mine, and she showed me some videos on YouTube of you know, just people playing, and I just was kind of possessed by an unquenchable thirst to play roller derby.
A frenzy.
A frenzy that continues to this day, though I sound quite controlled about it now. It's definitely become part of my life. In fact, it has become my life.
Yeah.
It's me.
Yeah, life. I had a bunch of friends who were doing it as well who got involved right from the word go, and they were just raving about it and talking about how much fun it was, and I did nothing outside of work much, I think, or just socialising, and I was like, oh, it'll be fun, and the roller skates and the drama and getting dressed up and having a fake name, but it's been the actual fact that it's like a sport and it's got all of that kind of stuff behind it that's really held me, I think, so yeah, it's pretty exciting, good fun. How about you?
Well, I heard about it when I was in Auckland, but I lived up there for a couple of years, but I couldn't play because I was too far away, I didn't have a car, blah, blah, too lazy. And then I got back to Wellington, and that's when I really decided I wanted to play, because just, you know, you hear about roller derby and you never get it out of your head. I think you know immediately if you're going to play.
Yeah.
And I just always wanted to, so I emailed the Auckland girls, and they're like, it's just starting, they're just getting started, so I got in touch with the girls, and went to my first skate in an underground car park and hit into lots of cars, and it was awesome.
And I came to the first bout and couldn't stop thinking about it.
And
now she's playing.
Now I'm playing.
Have you guys skated on TSB Arena before?
This morning.
Yeah. Do you think there's going to be much difference between there and the Newtown?
Oh my god, well it's four times as big.
Significantly different.
Floor's better.
Floor's way better. Like, it's a really fast floor though, I think.
It's good.
Yeah, but not so slidey, like the one at the Newtown. Yeah, the fast but grippy. The Newtown one was a little bit like, somebody described it a little bit like ice skating. It was quite hard to control yourself on the corners, so.
Here we geek out about wheels and floors.
You stop before the geeking out.
That's fine, yeah.
Not to mention it's warm.
The warm's nice.
So what's your role in the team and how do you do that?
We're all in the same team. I'm just a blocker, so my job is to help our jammer and to not help the opposing jammer.
Yeah,
most of us do a bit of both.
So jamming is a point scorer, which is the other position, basically. If you're not, I mean, you can be a blocker, a pivot, or a jammer. And the jammer's job to score points for the team. So they have to skate through the pack, and the other team's blocker, as TV said, either has to assist or impede them. So it's kind of a little bit the glamour position when you come out the end.
The jammer's definitely kind of, I mean, you can't have a star on the helmet, come on.
I think all the positions are so. The pivot's like sort of the pace keeper and stuff, and sort of have a strategic role within the team, which is kind of long-winded to explain. But I think the point is, it's like whatever position you play, like you just can't operate as a team without everybody playing. But playing to the best of their ability.
And I mean, my favourite position is blocker three, which is the blocker at the end of the pack. And basically, like, they get the first shot at everyone.
I'm just really nervous now.
Are you?
I mean, excited.
It's going to be awesome.
How much do you know about the other teams in the country? Is it possible there might be a city matchup at some stage?
Yeah, well, we've just formed a national roller derby association with the other with Christchurch and Auckland's league. So absolutely, that's what we're aiming to do early next year.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, we have quite a lot of communication, and we skate with them and they skate with us. Like, whenever anyone travels around the country.
I'm going up to skate with the Plymouth in 2 weeks' time.
Plymouth is another league.
Yeah.
Northland.
Hamilton.
Yeah.
So, yes.
And it's great because everybody sort of shares their knowledge and sort of like it encourages everybody else. We got heaps of support from the Pirates when we were first starting up, and I think everyone's been... Some of these girls went down to Christchurch to skate with Dead End Derby girls before their first bounce. So.
Yeah. And the cool thing is, like, you've got a family wherever you go, and that's overseas as well. If you email the American leagues and stuff, they'll put you up.
And I went and skated in New York.
You know, like,
yeah.
I was there and doing
instant swell. Family all over the world.
Yeah.
Terrifying, but amazing. Really hot.
It's the same because Goldie's going to the Gold Coast, and she's already been in a lot of contact with the Gold Coast team over there. I don't know what their name is.
Sun State.
Mm.
So, as a spectator, it kind of reminds me a bit of motor racing.
Stock cars?
Yeah, well, just in that you don't want anybody to get hurt, but you're secretly hoping to see a crash.
Well, there's lots of crashes, but we train so that we don't get hurt.
Yeah.
That would be defeating the purpose.
Yeah. And it's so sad when people, it's just heartbreaking.
Yeah, it is. But there are a lot of crashes. That's kind of one of the things about roller derby. It's that fearless aspect of things, you know?
Yeah.
It's risk and putting yourselves on the line.
And there's just something so cool, you know, when you're taking a big spill and everyone's, and you're like, oh wow, just get up.
Now, the coolest thing is when you get hurt and then you go, hey, that really hurt, but I'm okay.
Yeah.
That's awesome. I can handle anything, and it actually strengthens you outside of roller derby as well.
Yeah.
You know, you can anything can happen, and you know you can take it.
Absolutely, yeah. It changes your attitude towards all sorts of things. You're like, fuck, if I can do all this crazy shit, then, yeah.
Okay, tell me a bit about the costumes. How do you decide the costumes?
Well, it's pretty much whatever you feel comfortable in, right? So the teams have themes. So our team theme in Brutal Pageant is Disgraced Beauty Queens. So it's kind of like a hyper-feminine thing. It's a little bit draggy. And essentially we just chose colours and, whatever we feel comfortable wearing.
It's very individual.
Does somebody make them for you, or do you buy them, or...?
We source every different part of our costume from wherever we want. It's up to the individual to put it together.
So it's kind of like a sex appeal to the sport. Is that something you guys kind of play on, or does it just kind of happen?
Unless it's a natural response to guilt doing something like that, but it's not what we focus on.
Yeah, it's not what we focus on. I mean, really, one of the things is that all women's sport kind of has that element to it, and it's kind of acknowledging that. Really, so it's not
a
major focus,
playing with that as well.
Yeah.
Like I think there's a lot of with the way that the images in roller derby and the sort of everything about it is is hyper real. Like, it's all about playing with sort of imagery and ideas and all of that kind of thing, and sort of, yeah, a manipulation of all of those ideas about women's sport should be like this, and like, women's shorts should be like this.
And the cool thing about it is that it is what you want it to be for yourself, and that thing about choosing your own costume is that you can wear whatever you want, and so if it's something you want to play on, you can, and if it's something you're completely uncomfortable with, you don't have to go there, and I think that's what's really awesome about it, because there's lots of different kinds of women that play roller derby, from all sorts of backgrounds.
So up till now, you kind of have a bit of a hipster audience, I guess, so there seems to be a lot of people in the crowd who don't go to other sports. What, why do you think that is?
Because we're an event.
We're
a spectacle.
It's a full experience. But I think there's something quite nice about it. It's like, I've never had an interest in sport my entire life. No. Since I've been doing this, I'm like, oh, I wouldn't mind going and seeing some other sports and seeing what that was like as well. I mean, that bad. So, I don't know, I think it's good. It's just, it's nice having something, like another alternative rather than just,
there's a lot of sports fans that are into it though. They really are.
And it's cool because they're the ones that really recognise how much we put into it.
So it's like,
some of it, because some people just don't really acknowledge that at all, and actually we train so hard.
Insanely hard.
And it takes out so much of you to play a game.
How much training do you do then?
Like four times a week leading up to a game.
Yeah,
and that's like sort of two and a half hour trainings at a time. And on top of that, we have meetings to run it. Yeah, it really does.
Great, yeah, thanks very much.
Heartbreaker. Breaking Hearts from the Heart Valley. Wellington podcast.
7th of November, TSB Arena, it's our final.
The next show is 7th of November at PSB Arena.
Yeah, the big one.
Wellington electronic musician and soundtrack composer Rian Sheehan recently played a show at the Downstage to launch his album Standing in Silence. I talked to him before the show.
You've got a show on this Sunday. Can you tell us a bit about what's going on there?
Yeah, I'm playing a show at the Downstage this Sunday, the 18th of October, and it's the first time I've played the new album Standing in Silence live. The album came out in February through Loop, and it's taken this long to really find the right venue and find the right people to do it. So it's we're bringing the album, which is, you know, essentially kind of a studio album, into a more live environment, really. There's 12 players involved. No, 13, is it? Yeah, 13 players. A five-piece string section. Yeah, and quite a heavy visual element going on. Yeah, should be interesting.
It's going to be at the Downstage at the nice early time of 7 p.m, which I really like myself.
It's not a long show either. We're playing the whole album from start to finish, so
okay.
It should be about just over an hour long, I imagine. Well, an hour 20, maybe? Yeah.
Do you feel like having it at the Downstage lets you do some things that you wouldn't be able to do at a pub or...
Oh, absolutely. You know, because people, when they're paying money to come and sit down and watch you, they kind of have no choice but to kind of sit down and you know, and look at what they're facing at. But in a pub, it's different. You know, you can meander off and go and get a beer if you, and you, you know, yak away to people. And the album, the last album, was very, you know, it kind of, in order to really get kind of sweeps away in the music, I think you need to, you know, for the music to envelop you, I think you need to really sit down and kind of pay attention and listen to it. There's a lot of hidden kind of textures and things floating around in the music, and it's not as blatant as my other albums, but I think there's a lot more going on in a different kind of sense in the new album. And because the visual element is such a massive part of it as well, you know, the Downstage is perfect for me. And it's not too big and it's not too small, it's kind of the perfect size. It's intimate enough to work, but not too small.
Well, that kind of answers my second question, which is you don't play live that often.
I used to. I haven't played for the last, I think one of the last shows I played was in Spain, actually, which is a year and a half ago. And I haven't played in New Zealand since then. Well, the reason being I went off and wrote that album. And then I kind of fell out of love with what I was doing electronically a little bit with my previous stuff and my previous shows, so I wanted to kind of reinvent the sound and take it to a different place. So that's why it took me so long. And I've been offered shows, people have asked me to play gigs and dance parties, and I haven't felt ready. I haven't felt like I've had a proper show together. So that's the reason.
Yeah, I thought it was kind of an irony that an album that's kind of described as meant to be listened to alone.
going to be a whole lot of people listening to it all.
Yes.
It's kind of like watching a film, I guess, in the sense that you're all sitting there experiencing the same thing.
You know, standing aside, it's a metaphor for, you know, finding that place within yourself, and that's what happens when I listen to music, and it just kind of envelops me. It is almost like a silence, because the fact that I'm physically listening to something kind of detaches from me mentally, and it becomes more subliminal, and it's just, I'm alone there with the music, you know. So I guess that's where I was going with it.
So you do quite a, getting some work on sound, doing the soundtrack for the show The Cult, I believe?
Yes, yeah, I've almost finished that one. I'm on to the last episode, 13 at the moment, so that's fun. It's quite different, because it's obviously it demands a different style of music, so it's very different to anything previously that I've done, but especially in the latter episodes, or actually from this Thursday onwards, it starts to get very textural and broody. And I guess there's, you can definitely hear that it's stylistically slightly that it's my style, but there's a lot of action music as well and things that it's been a real experience. I've done a bit of soundtrack work, but I've never worked on such a massive, you know, series.
Yeah.
With such kind of tight deadlines, you have to kind of throw out all your own ideas about what you know, what you think is good musically, or what suits your own style, because that's not what it's about. It's about telling the story, and you need to serve the story, and that's the big lesson I've learned from this one. You need to write what needs to be written in order to help the story, basically.
So when you're putting together the soundtrack, do you get to see a rough cut of the episode first, or do they tell you that we need an exciting piece of music for 46 seconds?
No, they send me the scripts, and I read the scripts. And I usually jot down ideas for each of the, you know, some. I go through it and figure out what key scenes I think are the key scenes. And a lot of it's just transitional music that, you know, the audience kind of needs to be subliminally told a lot of time that they're going from one scene into another.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, they'll send me the final cut, and I'll write the entire soundtrack to the final cut. And then any tweaks, the director will look at it, and if any tweaks need doing, they'll ask me to write something new, or, you know, they'll shuffle things about. But generally it's been amazing, actually. The producer Rachel Gardner's kind of left it up me up to my own devices on it, so they've given me kind of creative freedom to go and do what I want without being too full on, which is amazing, I think. For something, it's like an $8 million budget TV series, there's a lot of hype around it, but they just seem so almost cavalier about what I do, but I think that's a good way for me to work.
What are some of your inspirations in film soundtracks?
Oh, I'm a huge film buff. Big film. Me and my wife Rashi, every night we'll sit down and watch a Blu-ray. Big high def fanatics, so we're big film buffs. But so many soundtracks, my God. But I guess my favourite composers are international composers, Cliff Martinez, who's just like probably one of the best film composers, I think, for that genre in the world. And other composers like Clint Mansell, I really like his stuff. You know, he did a film called Moon recently. It's a low budget sci-fi Moon.
It just came out, that one.
Yeah, it just came out. And Requiem for a Dream and The Fountain, beautiful soundtracks. Locally, I think it's not a massive amount to choose from, but I think Victoria Kelly, she's an Auckland based composer, I think she's doing some stunning stuff, and she's already done a few features, but she'll go on to do really big things, I think.
Do you have much relationship with any of those other composers?
I think I've had more to do with kind of composers overseas than I have locally.
Yeah.
It's kind of funny, I think this day and age, you know, just with the internet and Facebook and everything, it's so easy to get in touch with people, and it's surprising. You know, like I've gotten in touch with some of my kind of soundtrack heroes, and it's amazingly surprising like how many of them will actually get back to you. And it's incredible.
Yeah.
Like I've struck up relationships with a few, you know, and some of my favourite bands. So
actually, on the travel subject, it seems like travel's a bit of a inspiration for you, and some of your album was recorded in like India and China and so forth. How did that sort of come about? Was that a real deliberate decision, or?
Yeah, it always is. I've got a little sound recorder, and I'm always traveling with it and recording sounds and environments, really. And I guess I kind of approach music in a funny way, that I kind of approach it when I'm writing a track. It's more like approach it from an environmental way, like what is the sound of, what is the feeling of that space? You know, like when I'm listening to these field recordings, I'm thinking, you know, what feeling did I have when I was in that place? You know, and the music usually kind of comes out of that for some reason. So the last album was very much made with that intention, really. A lot of it's actually, a lot of it was recorded in Tokyo, a lot of the soundscapes. So a lot of it's, to me it sounds like Tokyo, the album, because I can hear all the meandering kind of Tokyo-esque crowds in the background, you know, floating around. But travelling is definitely a big influence.
Would you say, is there much of your music that gets moulded by Wellington?
You mean stylistically?
Yeah, stylistically. Is things like the local weather an influence, or anything
I thought you meant that local music is an influence. The weather, I guess, yeah, there's a certain, you know, we just got back from India a few weeks ago, actually, and Thailand. And whenever you travel and come back to Wellington, I guess you realise that there is quite a heavy sense of isolation here. You know, like it is quite an isolated place, and it's not incredibly vibrant like other places around the world. Yeah, I do feel a sense of isolation in living in New Zealand. I mean, I love the place, it's beautiful, but there is a lot lacking, I think. There's a lot of cultural vibrancy that's missing from this country, but that's because it's such a young country and such a small country with such a small population. But, there's also a lot of great things about this country, but I think that comes across in the music, definitely, yeah.
So you've got another side project called Lust Response, which I have to say I'm a really big fan of.
Oh,
is there any chance of getting some of Lust Response stuff happening?
Unfinished. Well, yeah, that's it's a funny one, that one. We've recorded about 9 tracks, but they haven't. They never got to a point. I think one of them did. One of them got to a point where it was kind of releasable on the radio, but they never really, you know. We've chucked a few on MySpace, but it was more like it was Paul McLaney and Rashi Malik and Jeremiah Ross Module. It was more, we all have this massive love for kind of 80s synth pop, which some people just, you know, will regurgitate at the thought of, they just can't handle it. We're massive, you know, I'm actually a closet fan of Tears for Fears and bands like that. I love that because it's really hooky music. That project wasn't, originally it was just kind of fun, and Paul would come down from Auckland and stay, and we'd just drink wine and end up writing some 80s inspired track. But I don't think there's any more plans to do any shows at this point. Unfortunately, sorry. I'd love to, though.
That's all I have, really.
Oh, great. Cool. Awesome.
Fortunately, the show was sold out, so it doesn't matter too much that this podcast was released after the date. In fact, I got the last 2 tickets, and it was well worthwhile. Next up, we talk to a couple of tourists.
I'm Cheryl.
Yep. I'm Brian.
And where are you from?
Randwick in Sydney.
What made you come to Wellington? What are you here to do?
We've just done a week in the South Island. Flew up from Christchurch to Wellington today. We pick up a car tomorrow, and we drive to Auckland to fly home.
What do you like so far about it?
We've been walking around the harbour, the area around the harbour, and that seems really nice. And I like the way it's all parks and, you know, it's sort of nice and casual, and it seems to be really well utilised.
Yeah, cool. And anything you don't like about it?
Hills?
Yeah.
There's nothing cool that I've seen so far that I don't like. About you?
Yeah, it was mostly afternoon at the museum.
Te Papa.
Oh, yeah. Papa. It was quite an interesting. We spent about
4 hours
there. Probably really doesn't do it justice. You really got to, I suppose, say spend the day, or maybe do
come back a few days.
Maybe a floor a day, you know, a floor each 4 or 5 times. Mm. So you can do a bit more detail of it. There's a lot to cover.
Yeah, indeed. Cool. Finally, today we're talking to Claire Medcalf. Claire is Wellington's only full-time quiz mistress, and she also runs an events company.
My name's Claire Medcalf. I've lived here for about 10 years. We're currently sitting in my house.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful view of Thorndon.
So tell us a bit about what you do.
So I have run my own event management and entertainment business for just over a year. Previously, I was working for a PR company. I've been involved with working on events for about 6 or 7 years. And one day I just realised that I couldn't be bothered working for someone else's profit, and I had enough stuff behind me to be able to quit my job and start working on my own business. So I incorporated my company, which is called Infinite Ingenuity, which is suitably vague in terms of description of what it is I do, because I do quite a wide variety of different events and entertainment things. I'm a bit of an entrepreneur as well.
Tell us about some of the projects that you've done.
Well, I'd probably most be well known in Wellington for running quiz nights. I've been running quiz nights for around 6 years. How I got into that is I was station manager of Munt FM, and I wanted to try and find ways of promoting the radio station, and somehow I managed to connect a quiz night to a radio station promotion, which is a little bit of a stretch. So I started running quiz nights at Massey. From there, I was walking along the street in Newtown one day past Newtown Sports Bar, and I thought, hey, you know what, I could earn money from doing this. So I went in there, I pitched a quiz night to them, were a bit higher cost than everyone else, and they went for it. So from there I started going into getting paid to do it. At the moment, I host the quiz night at the Kiwi Pub on every Wednesday, which is on at 7:30. I've been in that venue in its various different machinations, which is, it's now the Kiwi Pub, it used to be the Courtney Arms, for about 5 years I've been there. But the Kiwi Pub quiz has got a Kiwi bent, so if you're not Kiwi, then you might be a bit stuck, but you'd be surprised how many non-Kiwis come along. Anyway, I also run a really good quiz on a Thursday night, which is the movie quiz at the Paramount, which is at 9 o'clock every week, and that's basically a quiz night for movie geeks. It's pretty damn hard. It attracts quite a unique crowd. So, and winners, it only goes for an hour because it's on quite late, and winners of that win 2 weeks unlimited movies to the Paramount, which is quite cool because they always have really good movies on there.
Tell us about the quizzes at Kiwi Pub. How do you come up with the questions for that?
To be honest with you, I actually use a person to create the Kiwiana round for me because I'm obviously not a Kiwi. So I started trying to do it for a little while and realised I wasn't the best at it. So that little segment of the quiz is, I pay someone else to do that for me. But one of the other rounds that we do is news, and so I'll take the news from stuff probably on the day, on Wednesday, but if I'm feeling onto it, it's Tuesday and Wednesday, and so the people are quizzed on the current affairs affecting New Zealand. So in that sense, you can kind of revise a little bit.
But in terms of the other rounds, like what's like one of the weirdest questions you've ever had to come up with?
It's not so much a weird question, but some quizzes are quite unique and they don't take themselves very seriously, so it depends on the audience. So if I can get away with doing risque types of quiz rounds, like I particularly like doing the handout rounds, where in the past, particularly when I was doing the quiz at Massey, we did at rounds like arse or elbow. So I don't know if you've ever bent your elbow across like that and taken a little picture of it. And it sometimes can look like a bottom. And the quiz was, can you tell if it was like pictures of 10 people's arses or elbows? And another one we did was female or she-male, which was quite scary for some of the blokes that were in the room. So obviously you had to try and guess whether the person in the picture was a man or a woman, a man dressed as a woman. Oh, I'm just getting a bit rude now, but one of them was bought face or come face. Well, yeah, so if you imagine right. Someone, yeah. So.
Right.
So if I can get away with being a little bit risque or just a little bit, for example, at the Kiwi Pub, this one didn't go down very well, actually. A recent picture round was I just basically took mug shots of people who had committed various crimes, gave them the list of the crimes, and you had to identify which person you thought had committed the crimes. So it was like assault with a deadly weapon, methamphetamine manufacturing with all these crazed people. But that didn't go down very well, but I do like doing interesting things like that. And I like to think that because in Wellington and in New Zealand, the market for quiz nights is dominated predominantly by one company, which is called Livewire. So you're pretty much getting a consistent product across the board. And the reason why I think I'm able to command a little bit of extra fee and also better audiences that I do things I don't, it's not quite so serious, and a little bit of variety in there. So
So I guess you spend a lot of time researching questions on the internet and stuff like that. You've been wrong many times about a question?
I have, and in some pubs it's quite good because we have access to Google. I mean, it's not often that I'm wrong, but sometimes I am. In a situation where we have Google, we basically just Google it. Yeah. But even in a situation where I don't have access to the internet, I will generally not accept any other answer than the one that's written down on the page. Even though I might know that the answer is wrong, it can just cause enormous amounts of debate. So it's basically, if I stick to the rule, what's on the page, that's the answer I get. Otherwise, we're just going into... Because some people will come and argue at me and say, that question is flipping wrong. And then I can go away later and it's actually not wrong. People just think they're right. So I can't often rely on the fact that the audience are coming up to me going, that question's wrong. I just have to try and judge it as it goes.
Perhaps if they have a business card showing themselves to be an expert in the field, it might be...
Yeah, that would be okay.
Does that mean you're now like a font of useless information and you're always boring your friends with trivia?
Actually, no. People always try and take me along to quiz nights, and I'm actually not very good. Because I've been doing it for 6 years, the way that I can justify my uselessness at quizzes is that because I actually deal with so much information, I just don't store it away. It's not useful information for me, really. No, don't try and take me along to a quiz, so I'm not going to be very good. But I have actually got better at movie stuff since I've been doing the movie quiz. I'm not a movie buff in any way, shape or form, so it's been quite a good learning experience for me to go through the process of, A, finding out how geeky the people are that are coming, so what level to pitch the questions at, but doing the research for the quiz rounds is really interesting. So, and it's also provoked me into going out and watching different types of movies, and that's good.
Tell us a bit about some of the other projects you have on the go or that you've done lately.
Well, one of the things I've just recently brought over to New Zealand is an event called Bogan Bingo. We had an article in the newspaper on Sunday, which was quite good. So the Bogan Bingo is a really funny event, which is basically a cross between comedy and theatre and bingo, of course. Basically, people are encouraged to dress in Bogan-esque wear, so maybe drag out a mullet wig, or if you've got an AC/DC t-shirt in the back of your wardrobe, some spray-on peel-off jeans or something. People come along and we participate in a couple of games of bingo and we have a riotous time. It's quite risque, lots of crowd interaction, air guitar competitions, and just unlike anything I've ever seen before. I saw it originally when I was away in Australia. I went to the event and I immediately contacted the guy that ran it, who has the trademark for it, and I said, I want to bring this over to New Zealand. So about 3 weeks ago, we brought over an Australian Bogan to train us up in the ways of Bogan, and we had...
Oh, surely you could have got a local.
We could, and actually the difference between Australian Bogans and New Zealand Bogans is there is a difference, so we've had to adapt the show a little bit, take a lot of the Australian stuff out. We had a three-date tour. We had a date in the hut, we had a date in downtown local, and the offer was the best. We hopefully are looking at doing a monthly event there on the last Friday of every month. And following on from that, we're looking at doing it at other pubs and orientation, corporate gigs, hen night, dad nights, etc. Now we've got the event locked down. It's going to be really cool. Another thing that I have is a website called hitthetown.co.nz, and that is a new project of mine that's been going just this year. I built myself a website. Well, I didn't. I paid someone to build it. And I thought, well, actually, what is going to get people to come to my website? Because it was just a static page. And in order to drive people to come, you need something that's useful to look at. So I thought of the idea of creating a site that lists where all the quiz nights are. When I was researching quiz nights and poker nights, I realized that there's actually a whole lot of really cheap, regular entertainment going on in Wellington that isn't covered by any of the guides. So, in short, Hit the Town is a website you can go onto to find cheap drinks, meal specials, poker nights and nights, and the odd other little thing that goes on, like the Jenga competition at the Cross, for example. And so you can go on site, you can think, oh, you're a Tuesday night, you want to have a cheap meal. Like, for example, I went out last night to Maxim Cafe, we had 2-for-1 mee goreng, it was really good. and it costs us under $20 for a couple of meals and some wine. So it's really about recession busting as well. And in the pipeline, which I'm really excited about, okay, picture this, right? You're in town with your friends, and you don't have an iPhone, so you can't access my website via your flash iPhone, like most people. So what you do is, you want him some cheap drinks, and so it's 7 o'clock on Wednesday night, you text a short code, a 7 p.m. Wednesday, and it'll take back the list of where all the cheap on at that very moment for only 20 cents. So hopefully that's going to be happening within the next month or so. The other thing I'm working on, which is the Massey University Blow Festival, which is going to be really awesome, with fashion and art and lots of lectures, but predominantly I'm doing the fashion show, which is a great, awesome event.
Just a few corrections from Claire's interview there, where the sound cut out. The pub she was talking about with the Bogan Bingo was the office in Newtown. And the last bit she mentioned was about how you would get a text update of bars with drink specials. If you enjoyed the podcast, please let us know. Or if you'd like to contribute, or you have any suggestions. If you'd like to get in touch, you can email wellingtonpodcast@gmail.com. And you can also look on our website, which is wellingtonpodcast.blogspot.com. The podcast is available on iTunes. If you have iTunes on your computer, just go to the music store and look under podcasts, search for Wellington. And then you can subscribe so that each new episode gets automatically downloaded to your computer. I'd like to say thanks to everybody who participated. It's been a lot of fun, and I hope you'll be listening for the next episode in November, when we'll be featuring an interview with Wellington Civil Defence head honcho Fred McCoy, and hopefully we'll be chatting to the All Whites ahead of their big game.